Good afternoon. My name is Pat Hayden, and the session this afternoon is called Being a Stranger in a Strange Land. I would like to share with you a little bit what I do and what it is that led me to this particular topic. I work for Lutheran World Ministries, which is a cooperative agency of the American Lutheran Church, the Lutheran Church in America, and the Association of Evangelical Lutheran Churches in New York City. And there I work as the director of the International Scholarship and Exchange Program. My primary responsibility is to be the program administrator for the Lutheran World Federation International Scholarship Program, which provides leadership training opportunities for men and women of Lutheran churches around the world. At the present time, we have 59 such programs in the United States that are taking place in 23 states and 21 different institutions. I'm sorry, that's reversed. 23 institutions in 21 states. There are about 120 people that my office is responsible for. We provide visas and make travel arrangements, get people admitted to schools, provide individualized training programs for them. Those of you who have had sons and daughters or yourselves have gone to college or graduate school, it's like getting 30 people a year into school, except you're doing it at long distance from Tanzania and Hong Kong, from Brazil, from Chile. So it's been a very interesting job. What I wanted to do this afternoon is to share with you a little bit of what I have learned from all of these men and women who come about what it's like to come to the United States for the first time, what it's like to be here as a stranger and to be in the United States, which for them is a strange land. I would hope that I could go through several points and then we would have some time for discussion. I would invite you, if anything is unclear, or you have an experience that you would like to share that's related to that point, that you just interrupt me and share it with us all. First of all is the decision to come. It is a decision that is not easily taken. To go abroad to another place for 6 months, 9 months, 1 to 5 years, which the students do who come for undergraduate or graduate programs. But it is a decision taken not only individually, but in the corporate sense. All of the people that I work with are nominated by their churches to come and get a specific kind of training and to go back and then share that in the church as a leader with their own people. But having made the decision to come, it is an adventure. It's full of expectation, full of excitement, full of enthusiasm. At the same time, it's full of that bittersweetness that comes when you leave your family and the place that you're comfortable and go a long way away. We feel in our office that the time that they arrive, either at John F. Kennedy Airport or wherever they are, is probably one of the most critical times ever. How many of you have ever gone to someplace strange and been there without anybody to meet you or greet you or help you? Do you remember that feeling of terror and absolute bewilderment and lostness? If you come to John F. Kennedy Airport in New York, it's magnified. I mean, this airport goes on and on and on. And if you tell somebody, as my predecessor did, well, just take the bus into the city, if you go out there and look, you will discover that there are 8 different buses painted 6 different colors with 8 different names on them. How in the world could you possibly know which was the right bus to choose and where it was going to take you? So during July to September, the other 2 members of my staff and I will make 30 trips to John F. Kennedy Airport to welcome people to the United States, to greet them as they come through customs, and to share the ride with them back into New York City, and to help them in that initial 24 or 48-hour period of being in the U.S. It's really just nice to leave all of that to someone else. Then, when they get to actually where they're going, the school or the town, the community, they go through the process of settling in, and everything around them is new. The food is new, the stores are new, the streets are new, the transportation is new. Every single thing that you can imagine is new. even sleeping, the way the kinds of beds we have in many cases are new, the sort of noise level that there is, and especially the language, English. Even if they have learned English, as all of them have before they come, English is not the same as American. And it's not the same American that's spoken in North Carolina, or spoken in Kansas, or spoken in Maine, or spoken in California. It's all very different. And as a result of this settling in, it's exhausting. Another thing I've learned is that the business of having always to live in a language that isn't your own takes an enormous amount of energy. Just listening to people who speak a language that's not your own just takes all the concentration you can muster. I went for the first time in this job to Geneva for a meeting, and I sat there in meetings 6 hours a day and listened to people from all over the world speaking English, and that's my mother tongue. And at the end of the day, I was just wiped out, just beat down to my shoe tops, just from trying to translate the cadence of people who were speaking English with a little bit different rhythm than was quite comfortable and familiar to my ear. You can imagine that during those first several weeks then, the process of settling in, you learn by bits. You are just overwhelmed by stimuli, and some of them you absorb, and some of them you translate correctly. A lot of them you don't absorb, and you have to relearn them again at a later time. I think the next thing that happens is probably something that all of us are familiar with to one extent or another, and that's culture shock. It's a very real phenomenon, and it has both emotional and mental manifestations, as well as many physical manifestations. It's characterized by depression, by loneliness, by withdrawal, by illness sometimes, physical stress, all of those symptoms of indigestion and headaches and sleeplessness, insomnia, lack of appetite, which are commonly associated with stress. And culture shock is primarily the stress of distances between the expectations that they had before they came and the reality that they've encountered. The distance between home and where they are physically living now. It's often exaggerated for many of them by the fact that the males are very slow to come in the early months of being here, especially if they're from Southern Africa. It often takes a month, 6 weeks, 8 weeks for a letter to go from here home and one to come back again. And that's a long, long time when you have just gone away from home. I think the other stress of distances is between your attempt to communicate on the one hand and the success of that communication on the other hand, your language and your ability to be understood. And finally, I think part of culture shock is personalizing the cultural insensitivities that you run into. Now, we Americans have all kinds of habits which we just so take for granted. We like to say to people, come on over. Visit, you know, anytime you feel like it, come on over and have a cup of coffee with me. That is very often heard as inhospitality, just exactly the opposite of what we expect it to be, because we haven't taken the time to issue a personal, specific invitation. Will you come to my house this afternoon for tea at 4 o'clock, and I will come and collect you? You know, the distance between that kind of personal specificity and come anytime is very hard for students from other countries to get used to. We are very busy. We welcome people very warmly when we first meet them, wish them well, hope they'll have a good time, and then almost ignore them from their perception of us. That we don't follow up with, again, greetings, saying hellos and goodbyes every time we see them. It's a funny kind of superficial hospitality. And it's not that we mean evil, it's simply that's what they experience from us. Finally, the expectation that we have that if someone is having difficulty, they will seek help. They will come to us and say, I need help. I'm lonely. I need this. I need that. Please show me how this is. That is not a common practice anywhere else. It's not necessary anywhere else because there's so much ongoing daily kind of communication between people that those needs and wants surface very easily. It's exaggerated in the United States for a lot of the foreign students because most of the people that they work with are authority figures. I am an authority figure as the holder of their visas and the issuer of their monthly checks. The dean of students is an official person. Even the pastor of a local congregation is an official person. And they have a somewhat different understanding of those official people than do we. And so it's not as easy to go and say, I need help. For this reason, and because these are things which are just part of who we are as Americans, part of culture shock is for the student to feel that these are all being directed against him or her as a specific individual. And they feel that no one understands, no one has ever had this experience before, and in its worst form, it really can produce quite a lot of withdrawal and very serious kinds of isolation. Sometimes it manifests itself as scorn and anger, comparing their way to our way and deciding that their way is better and they're not going to have anything to do with the U.S. They just reject everything that's here. On the other hand, it can be the flip of that and everything here is fantastic and they forget about what is at home. Culture shock is a very real phenomenon, and in our experience it sets in anywhere from a month to 3 months after the person has arrived. It depends on the person how long it takes them to get over that initial settling in period. Then the next stage is what I call the way back. And this is just a very, very important part of any stranger's experience in the United States. And I think that for the students I work with, there are two things that are most important in that way back. One of them is church, and the other is friends, companionship. All of the students who come through the program that I administer, and this is whether they're 18-year-olds or 45-year-olds, are related to a Lutheran church at home. They've been very active in a worship life and in a congregational life, and they miss that, and they want to be a part of that here. To sing in the choir, to attend church, to be part of Sunday school, to be active in potluck suppers, all of the things that we do, that is a very important part of beginning to feel at home here and not like a stranger. Companionship, friends, people who will listen become very, very important during this time, whether they're peers as schoolmates or other people that they meet in the community. Patience and perseverance are maybe things that are internal to them, but they become also very important vehicles on the road back. Prayer is an important and strong support for most of the students who come, and remembering the reason for which they came. Anything that can be done to encourage and support them with patience and prayer and reminding them of the goal that they have in being here and undergoing all this stuff in the first place is important. And what we provide by both congregations and people is the opportunity to talk. I know in my own life, not as a stranger, but just when I'm going through very difficult crises, the inability to articulate that struggle makes it worse. As soon as I can give words to it, as soon as I can give voice to it and begin to get it that distance from me and here to out there to someone else, then I am beginning to find those keys that help me cope with it, live with it, resolve it. But until I can give voice to that suffering, whatever it is, it's very, very painful and difficult and just kind of keeps going round and round and round in my own head. And the students have said very often just someone to talk to, someone to explain, express what they're going through and how difficult it is for them to be so far away from home, how homesick they are, what things are like at home, asking questions about what things are here. All of this is very, very important as a part of that way back. And I think that what happens if they can make it through that initial culture shock is they begin to feel at home. And then they find as an interesting new role being in the United States. They become people who are encountering all of the institutions and organizations that we have in this country. They become people who encounter all the rules related to the U.S. government, related to traffic, related to safety and health, social security cards, work permits, all of those kinds of things which are part of our own nation. They also become confronted for the first time in a genuine way with educational institutions, transcripts and courses and credits and classes. We have an educational system that is different from every one in the whole world. There's not another one in the world that has a pattern of education that is similar to our own. And that takes a great deal of getting used to. Then they encounter the experience of being a representative of their country. Doesn't matter whether they're a good one or a bad one, they are one, just by who they are and being where they are from. And they then are confronted with a wide range of requested and unrequested opportunities to educate Americans about their land and about themselves as people. I think I have often been insensitive to how involved a process this is, because one of the things that they deal with great good humor is how abysmally ignorant we are as Americans of the rest of the world. We don't often even know where the countries are located geographically, let alone anything about them. And when I go up to the top of the Empire State Building with a man who is from that tiny narrow strip of Namibia that sticks out into Botswana that is pure desert, and the town of Kavango is about 300 people, and he tells me when the Empire State Building was built, how tall it was, what it's made of, and all those kinds of things. You know, I don't even know that, and I'm an American, but they studied that in sixth grade geography, or the equivalent of sixth grade geography. So he's very excited because he's fulfilling a childhood dream to be going up the Empire State Building. I think we underestimate how much, in many cases, other people know about us and how little we know about them. I think what I'd like to talk about next is those are things which happen to everybody, every individual who comes through our program. I would say, because it's kind of a new thing, that we are having more and more families come. Not just an individual person who comes and lives in a dormitory of a seminary or college and studies for 4 years, but a family, like the Umzinelli family, that comes with a husband and a wife and several kids. And all of the things that I've said about what it's like to be a stranger are magnified by as many people as there are in the family, and the ages and experiences that they have in relation to their own age and peer groups. It's worse in some sense because most of our institutions do not have housing for families within the community of the educational institution. So it means they have to live off campus. And this provides some additional problems, primarily for the woman of the household. Because if the children are of school age, they immediately get into public schools or daycares and they begin to make friends with their own age group. The husband is usually the one that has the scholarship, so he's going full-time to school and he has professors and classmates to relate to. But the woman, what does she do? Where does she fit into the community? How does she make connections with other women and with the social institutions that are a part of our country? It's extraordinarily difficult. I think one of the
tragedies that happened that taught me this was that a woman from Botswana who was a registered psychiatric nurse in Botswana came, and because she could not get a work permit in the United States, which involved a lot of red tape with the government and lack of sensitivity both on the part of my office and the office and the school where her husband was studying, spent a whole year watching soap opera. She was refused to be volunteer help even in the college infirmary where she went and offered her services. The school did not have any facility for her to take classes, just of things that she was interested in. And after a year in utter frustration and disgust, she said, "I'm going home." And she just went back to Botswana, where she could live a life that was productive for herself. And I think that was an experience, a tragic one, because it meant that an experience which should have been something that husband and wife could have shared together and grown together became a very divisive experience. And she went back and was in Botswana for a year, and he continued in the United States to the end of his program, and then went back. And so not only did they not have a good experience here together, but she carries back a lot of negative feelings about the United States. Those things are going to happen, and we learned something from it. I hope that some of the other women who are here on the program will benefit. But it just illustrates the problems that are magnified when a family comes. Also, the struggle to remember culture and to adapt to U.S. culture. Mavis was telling me last night that Purity, their youngest daughter, does not know how to make the clicks that are part of the Zulu language because she learned English here and she hasn't heard enough Zulu so that she pronounces them the same way I do, which is with a k sound instead of the click, which I can't do either. But it's a very bittersweet blessing when a family comes. They really cherish the opportunity to all grow together and to experience things together because they do provide a support group for each other. But there is often a radical kind of culture shock when the children especially go home and have to fit back in to their peers and their home culture. Then when people get ready to go home, the things that I talked about all happen in reverse. There's expectation, anticipation, the adventure of finishing up their program, getting ready to go home, their arrival, their welcoming back into their family and friends, they're settling in, they're getting used to all the things that have changed and happened and gone on since they were there. And then finally, reverse culture shock, which is sometimes very difficult for people because so many things have changed and they themselves have changed. And a final thing, which is very often not spoken about, is the great amount of jealousy that happens when people have received an education and go home and others now regard them as being separate and apart. So they become people to be feared. And they're often quite distanced emotionally from the people that they left at home. This takes a long time to work through. And sometimes, you know, has its own kind of very sad consequences. A man who was just a superb student at Harvard, getting his PhD in theology, went home, and because the bishop was so threatened by him, he was assigned to a rural parish where he served for 3 years, and it was intended that he go to the seminary and teach, and he's a superb teacher. He's now been appointed to a university lecturer post so that he is able finally to do some teaching, but it's still not the position for which he was intended because the bishop is so threatened by his experience. There was an election recently for the Andhra Evangelical Lutheran Church in India, and there were only two candidates that came forward to run for that. And part of the credentials that they offered to the church for their running for that position were the fact that both of them had degrees from the United States. You know, that somehow put them above the others. So I think we sometimes forget that in the rest of the world, the kind of education that we take so much for granted can create an elite, and be potentially very divisive, countering exactly what it should do, which is to encourage and inform and help and support the growth of the Church of God. That's all pretty heavy stuff, but it seems to me that it's important, because we very seldom hear students who come and share their life with us tell us about those things. We seldom know that that's what's going on with their experience of being strangers here. What kinds of things can we do, can you do, and can I do that make a difference? I'd like to just share a few of those things with you, and then open it up for some discussion and questions. First of all is to remember that they have a need to find out as much about the United States as they can within the limits of the program that they've come for. We often forget that they want to know about our music, our art, our museums, our culture, concerts, our festivals, 4th of July, and Memorial Day, Thanksgiving Day, and Christmas, St. Patrick's Day, Valentine's Day, all of those things which are a part of the regular rhythm of our life. We forget that they would like to know about the institutions of our church council meetings, synod meetings, district meetings, pastoral conferences, lay people's conferences, studies, all of those kinds of things which we don't often think of inviting people to. And about our political system, especially how people register and vote, local elections and county elections and committees and juries and all of those kinds of things which make this country very special and different from most other countries in the world. So anything that we can do to introduce them to those things, to share those processes with them, gives them a wider and a deeper understanding of this country than they might have otherwise. If you live in a place which has a college, I would encourage you to support both the college in their international student program and those international students that come. Most of the Lutheran colleges are really just beginning international student programs, and they're as unsure as anyone on what exactly is involved to have students come and study from other countries. Only a very few have had international students for a long, long time. They need support. They need congregational support. They need host families, people who will just be there to help answer questions and to be friend in the roundest sense of that word, these students who come. I'd like to say that in almost no case is there really a need for money. That's the thing that we Americans think of, first of all, that when an international student is in trouble, they need money. Sometimes that's true, but usually there are means and ways of helping students with money. What they need far more than that are people and contacts with people and the time, somebody to listen and to be helpful. I like to think of this as learning for global peace, and would refer you to this marvelous book which Mary Schramm has in the bookstore, which talks about people and all the different kinds of people that there are in the world, all the different languages, all the different customs, all the different dresses, all the different kinds of foods that we eat, all the different kinds of festivals that we celebrate, and talks about that wonderful rich diversity which is humankind around the world. And I think that the benefits that we get as Americans from sharing our lives with these strangers who come are many times far greater than they get from us. So with that, I'll stop. Yes?
I just want to underscore what you said about money. We're hosting Chinese students and discovered that they carry in cash several $100s all the time, and we're just flabbergasted with that. You know, go into the bank and cash a check for $300, you stick it in their back pocket, and, you know. I really believe that they think that all Americans do that. And we assured the young man that was at Barclays during the summer that he saw a lot of that with us saying, You got any money? I want to go to the store. Yeah, I think I got $2 or $3. Nothing, you know, and we would write checks.
Mm-hmm.
And they had checking accounts too, but they didn't like to write checks.
Well, that's something new. That's one thing that we need to remember is that really it's a very small percentage of people from around the world who ever get to go abroad to study. It is already the top 1% of people. And so the other thing I guess I've become very conscious of is that the people that I meet who are here studying in the United States may not be leaders someday in their countries. They will be leaders. It's a given. Within the 2.5 years I've been in my position, that one of the students is now the president of the church in the Philippines, the Lutheran church in the Philippines. Another is the president of the Anglo Evangelical Lutheran church in India. A third is in charge of all the women's work for the whole Lutheran church in Madagascar. And these are people who have learned off the senior executive leadership positions. And it is just a given that is what will happen after they've been in the United States. I sat on the floor and ate with a woman about 4 weeks ago, only to discover after I had eaten with her that she was Robert Mugabe's personal secretary, the Prime Minister of Zimbabwe. And she stayed for about 18 months to get some specialized training and then she'll go back to Zimbabwe. I just wanted to tell you something about you said that the letters in 2007 to the expression of the 900. And I suggest they're not the logic of the particular advantage there. I think the intelligence does it all for women, but in the definition of the principle of the 6.72. Back in the U.S. and boy, we wish you were back in Virginia or anywhere.
But I think that it's very fascinating to hear her say initially in the school, and particularly a former student, my student from the Catholic Academy, we have an imagined effect that we have to do it, right? And it goes up in the year, it goes up to the year, it goes up to the year. And it comes back. Everybody wants to know, what is this person doing here today? What is this person doing here? Who is the person who has lived there all his life?
Thank you.
But what I need in my tradition is people like you who understand how it feels like. And who knows that the most important thing you can do for another person is that you can put your ticket on the top of the most important local parish church for 3 years and was treated as a guest every Sunday. And, you know, that Mary Ethel responded to that with great good humor, but I just wasn't interested in truth, because that, you know, they come with a very strong witness and a very strong sense of the Christian faith, or they wouldn't undertake this incredible journey. And it would really be nice if they could experience our church and our congregational life as something welcoming and inclusive. Very often it isn't.
I've been a member of Francis of Timmy, but I wonder if Timmy doesn't have children in this. And Timmy doesn't seem to be doing a lot of that. In fact, I know there's really on campus. I do, in fact, I was at the beginning of the year, and had a chance to go to the school in the middle of the year.
My office isn't responsible for all of them that come. There are two different programs of foreign students who are Lutherans who come to the U.S. One is through my office, and the other two are through the mission board of the AFC and the RCA. And I don't know what their policies are with regard to language. We require some proficiency in English, which is measured by the international test called Test of English as a Foreign Language, or the TOEFL test. And most schools which admit foreign students have a score that is the minimum score they will accept of students on this test before they will admit them to work. What we find is that sometimes this is a good indication and other times it's not. Usually their ability to read and comprehend is excellent. Their ability to write and speak is very limited. So that's the reason why conversational groups are so helpful, because it's just same talking that includes the English.
We have a couple of these things. One of them is that when Spanish people are learning, I enjoy uncomfortable. The one thing I'm working is that usually I don't know where they're going to be. I want to know the meaning of the language that they were learning as a group in the state of health. I'm sure he asked of them. I'm afraid I don't understand what they said, and I know they don't understand what I said. And I just don't know all the time that. We have some of the famous experience about this human life is just about the other way. And we really have to come to peace with this thing. I'm feeling so sad. I haven't done it really sadly, but it was really exhausting to me. And you could really tell you when you got to listen to your talking to me. I was exhausted listening to them talking to me too.
And idiocies that you do, you know, the mistakes. that you know, it's just to hear. Because they know something about us, but still, again, their information about us is very much like ours about them. You know, it's sort of all abstract and at a distance, and at the governmental level or at the missionary level, et cetera. Just one other story. We have a student conference each year, and we bring all the students who are here on the LWS sponsorship together because it's a chance for them to meet each other. You know, people from Tanzania meeting people from Hong Kong, and the ones from Brazil meeting the ones from Liberia. They don't get that chance, so they're studying. And always we have in the evening talent nights and culture sharing nights, and everybody brings and say something from their own culture. And one of the men from Indonesia, who's really quite sad, last year when we were finished with all these culture evenings, said, "And now we will hear from our director, Mrs. Chan Asian." And he really caught me off guard. But he said, "You know, you have a culture, what are you going to do? What are you going to do from this over with us?" So this year I was prepared for Wally when he said that, and I got up and sang Old McConnell Had a Farm. Led that with the kids, you know, doing all the gestures and all these names and that. And what I couldn't predict beyond in time on my was this Tanzanian man who's about 55, is a medical doctor, has been in the United States studying public health for years, and he's just grinning from ear to ear, just lighting up. And he rushed up to me after he said, "I know what that song is now." He said, "The missionaries taught it to us when I was 8 years old." And he said, "I never knew a song that song from that." And then when I came to the United States 9 months ago, I saw this big thing which said McDonald's, and he had something to do with hamburgers. I didn't understand how that related to farms. He finally realized that Old McDonald was an American children's song.
Thank you.